Good afternoon. This is Jill EGZ, and this is a special edition of Family Matters today. As many or all of you know, there has been a horrible tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, and the Sandy Hook Elementary School was attacked yesterday by a very troubled young man. And we are going to talk about that today, give you your chance to voice your opinion, your thoughts, your condolences, your sympathies to those people in Connecticut that are so suffering. My co-host today is not Judge Michelle Laurent. She cannot comment on this issue on the radio, but I have our good friend, attorney Karen Conti, with us. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for being here today, and I think you're going to add a lot to this today. You have a brilliant legal mind. Of course, you're the CNN Fox contributor, legal contributor, and you know so much about so many different, a wide array of things, and I think that you also are able to be really in tune with people's emotions in a situation like this, so I really appreciate you being here with me today.
Sure, Jill.
We have with us right now on the phone Jeff Opperman, who is a dear friend and is living in Connecticut, not too far from where this happened. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
Good. Karen and I want you to tell us, Jeff, just give us kind of an idea of what the feeling is like in Connecticut right now in your area, because you and give us an idea of where you are geographically compared to the Sandy Hook Elementary School.
Well, sure. I'm in Danbury, Connecticut, which is probably 10-15 minutes from Newtown, and we're probably about 20-25 minutes from the Sandy Hook Elementary School. As a matter of fact, my stepson used to teach tennis lessons at the tennis courts right next door to Sandy Hook Elementary, so it is not far at all. And yesterday, as I was going to a doctor's appointment, I had to pass Danbury Hospital, and I saw the dozen or so television trucks parked outside Danbury Hospital, ready to report on what was happening with the victims inside the hospital. So it's very, very close, and it's very, very present for all of us.
Well, when you heard the news, obviously everyone's first instinct is just to be shocked, and then you have to move. If you don't have someone that's involved in the tragedy, you have to move to some kind of thinking process. I mean, if I were in Connecticut, I would have wanted to go immediately to try to help or to try to bring food or something to these people to try to alleviate some of the grief that they were feeling. But it's so hard in a situation like that when there's these little kids. And when I woke up this morning, I said to my husband, you know, I wonder how those parents right now who don't have their children are feeling. I wonder how they slept. And I thought, I bet they didn't sleep and they won't sleep. How do you think the community will come together to try to alleviate some of the suffering? How close-knit is that community where you are?
Well, it's a very close-knit community. If you've been following the news coverage, they've done quite a good job of painting a picture of Sandy Hook. It's about 25,000 people. It is a typical Connecticut, New England-type town, wide streets, old Victorian houses, wraparound porches. The houses are all decorated at this point for Christmas. The light posts going down the street are decorated. You know, if there was snow on the ground, you would have a postcard suitable for selling. That is what Newtown and Sandy Hook is like. And it's a very, very close community. And I think President Obama said it best yesterday on the television when he said, when we hear about something like this, we all react as parents. And, you know, the feeling of the unknown, the feeling of helplessness, the feeling of just incredible numbness that really kind of embraces the whole area really is overwhelming. And I know on, you know, your show, You talk about the stages of grief a lot, and I think the first stage is disbelief and numbness. And I think that's a pretty good description of what's going on in this area right now. Actually, I was just saying that a topic that I know you cover on your show quite often is the topic of grief and getting through grief. And the first stage of grief is this overwhelming sense of disbelief and numbness. And I think that pretty much for not only Sandy Hook, but Newtown and most of Connecticut, that's what we're talking about. The entire state, as well as much of the nation, is in that first stage of grief right now.
Are they talking about, Jeff, do you hear locally any kind of grief counseling for the kids? I mean, I know that when this has happened before, and all too often in cities across America, we're seeing this more and more in malls, in churches, in schools. Are they going to mobilize some kind of grief counseling for people other than the people at the school? Because as we hear on CNN and Fox News, they're saying that this isn't like the game 6 degrees of Seven Bacon. This is like everybody knew somebody that this has happened. I mean, there's a connection with everybody. So everybody's going to be affected by this, and I would think that it's going to have to be a mass grief counseling session for everybody.
Yeah, and it's just not, you know, the children who went to the school or the parents of the children. It's everybody who has been involved in this tragedy. The police officers and first responders are going to need grief counseling. I wouldn't be surprised if many of the local reporters, as well as the national reporters, needed some type of grief counseling after this. This is one of those situations that no matter what you're trained in and no matter how professional you are at what you do, you are just not prepared for something like this. The enormity of the grief, the enormity of the disbelief, the enormity of how could this possibly happen to 27 people, 20 of whom are, you know, probably less than 10 years old, nothing, no kind of training can prepare you for this kind of stuff.
Karen, I'd like to get your thoughts on this, because Jeff's exactly right. In most of life's dangerous situations, there's at least one or two warning signs of impending danger. And in this case, you know, we have storm clouds, animals gathering with their backs to the storm. You have warnings. But in instances like school shootings where students were simply doing what they do every day, it's just such a surprise. So what are your thoughts on this grief issue?
Well, you know, so many people have said so many things, it's hard to say anything original, but I thought it was an interesting comment, the idea that journalists will also feel this. I actually represented a Time magazine journalist who embedded herself in Columbine homes for a 2 or 3 week period following those shootings, which were fairly new at the time, and I have to tell you, she was not the same person before, after the instance, and she had to actually take off work and tend to herself because it was so absolutely traumatic for her as an outside journalist. So that's the first comment I had, and to just show you what the grief will do and how it spills over onto everybody, even people who aren't technically involved. You know, I think what people try to do in these times, Jill, is that they try to blame people. And, you know, we as lawyers get blamed for blaming people because we are the ones who are saying, well, who can be sued in this? It's such a tragedy. Our legal minds, the way we think in this country, you know, there must be somebody to blame. You know, there's a theater, you know, they should have had, you know, security guards at the theater. You know, this is the type of thing. Who do we blame here? How do we blame people? Apparently, the parents here were loving parents. The boy had issues. You know, the guns were legal as far as I have read so far. The school had security systems in place. Interestingly, in Illinois here, today, it was pre-scheduled, but in a little town called Kirkland, the school there is doing a mock school shooting drill. Isn't that ironic? That it was planned before this, and they're running through what they would do if they had a school shooting where they have a public address system and they have the police called and the children have a plan. I mean, you know, we used to have tornado drills. Remember that? Where we'd all sit against the wall. Now they're having school shooting drills. I mean, that's what we've come to here. And I'm not sure if that comment made any sense at all, but those are my initial thoughts.
No, I think that's a good comment. And just to add on to that, I heard a gentleman on Fox News today saying, you know, we have to train these kids to understand that this could happen. Now, is that taxing to their little minds? Of course it is. But he likened it to, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, they were taught to get under their desk to hit the floor if they heard anything that they didn't recognize. And the same with the tornado drill. I mean, this is what kids are taught to do. And maybe in this day and age, unless we can figure out why this continues to happen over and over, and I don't think we can say this is a random act anymore, because it's happening all the time. Jeff, do you have a thought on that?
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, if you're going to train, you can train to a point. But, you know, one of the comments I heard after 9/11 was that if somebody wants to fly a plane into a building, there's not much you can do about it. And I think there are some similarities when we start talking about situations like these. If someone is going to, you know, bring automatic weapons into a school and is ready to die and is going to open fire on everybody, there's probably not much you can do to prevent it, unless you start talking about issues like gun control and getting automatic weapons off the street. And I think that may be a topic that, you know, is going to come to the forefront of our minds in the next weeks and months. So, yeah, you can train and you can, you know, do all the right things. And I think, you know, you saw yesterday at Sandy Hook that a lot of the teachers, you know, saved a lot of children's lives thanks to their training. But, again, there's only so much you're going to be able to do if someone is intent on killing others and is ready to die for it.
You're right. And there surely were a lot of heroes there yesterday with the teachers. And I heard one terrific interview with a young woman who led the entire class into a bathroom and kept them as quiet as she could and tried to tell them that it was going to be okay. And I thought it was just so heart-wrenching when she said, I wanted to tell them that I loved them, because I thought it was going to be the last time they were ever going to hear that, because she really believed that they were going to die if he heard them and came to the door. And it was just such a, I mean, you could tell she had so much strength, but this had definitely taken a toll on her. But those teachers, the training that they had really, really worked for them. Unfortunately, two classrooms were the victims. It's just it's difficult to even talk about. Karen, what are your thoughts on lawsuits? Do you think, I mean, no lawsuit is going to make this any better, but do you think at some point there is going to be some litigious attorney in Connecticut that's going to try to group this together and make this an issue?
You know, there's always someone who's willing to do that, with the idea that you know, the lawyers will play upon the passions and the anger of these parents, because these parents have no one to lash out to. You know, the person who did this is dead. You know, school people were injured and killed. I mean, there's nobody to be angry at, and people want to have somewhere to put their anger, and sometimes there's a lawyer there who's ready and willing and able to do that. Now, I'm not saying that's a bad motive, and some of these types of tragedies that have evolved into lawsuits, which have maybe made things safer. And, you know, the only thing I can say here is, how could we have made the school safer? Do we go to a point where we have metal detectors everywhere? Do we go to a point where we have armed guards in a school? Do we go to a point where teachers have guns? Do we go to a point where we have doors that automatically lock and we have bulletproof windows? I mean, if that's where we're going, you know, I don't know that a lawsuit's going to, provoke that. I just don't know. I don't know what a lawsuit would be in this case. You know, people were talking about the fact that this child or this 20-year-old was a gamer, and that, you know, he played these violent games. And, you know, we have First Amendment rights. We can't stop people from creating these violent games. We all know that those things will move kids in that direction who are so inclined, but that has to be some sort of voluntary effort, not a lawsuit. So I just don't see a legal angle here that really could have prevented this, or it's going to prevent these things in the future, other than getting rid of all the guns in the country, and we're not going there. In fact, in Illinois, just a few days ago, our federal appellate court struck down the ban on concealed carry. So we are one of the last states to have concealed carry.
And we absolutely need concealed carry in Illinois. But unfortunately, this will now give our governor a real banner to carry, and that's unfortunate. I mean, there is nothing a lawsuit is going to do to make this any better. And I think looking forward and assessing what's happened in this shooting and previous shootings, and trying to determine why there are so many young people that are going this way is really, really important. So, Jeff, I want to let you go because I know you have family commitments, and I thank you for being here today. And if you hear anything that we can do to help the people in Connecticut deal with this, let us know, whether it's another show or anything that you think that we might be able to help with.
Okay. Well, Jill, thank you so much for that, and thank you for having me on the show.
I appreciate it. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Karen, we have Dr. Richard Warshak with us now. And Richard, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. This is Jill, and we have attorney Karen Conti, who's co-hosting with me today. And it is great that you could take the time to be with us, because you could maybe give us some insight into what's gone on. What are just your first comments about the school shooting, just off the top of your head, Richard?
Well, it's just such a horrible out of the ordinary event that it takes some time just to sort of wrap yourself around it and to try to understand the event and understand your reactions to it. And of course, as the adults are trying to do this, we're also trying to help children manage their thoughts and feelings about it. You know, when something like this happens, it sort of reminds me of, any sort of major trauma like the Challenger explosion or something like that, that the people sort of closest to it feel the impact the greatest, but then it reverberates. And it's certainly going to reverberate here. Parents are going to have a heightened awareness of risks and are going to be anxious. And even if they don't talk to their children about it, the kids are going to sense that something is different.
Do you think these children, now when they do decide to go back to school, and certainly out of a school that large, there are going to be children who are going to be apprehensive and frightened about walking back in those doors. What is the best way to deal with this issue with children? First of all, do you allow them to watch everything that's being replayed and said about the school shooting? Do you keep them as far away from it as you can?
I think it's difficult to generalize because the children are different, their ages are different, and their personalities are different. So I think generally the younger the child, the more you want to shield them from things that they don't, need to hear about. In general, I think people advise not allowing children to watch the television broadcasts of a trauma, but for some children that really helps them work through it. It desensitizes them to the anxiety by seeing, it over and over again, and helps them really come to terms with understanding what's happened. But for very young children, I think it depends in part upon how close they were to the actual trauma. In other words, to what extent did they actually witness horrific events and horrific scenes, which of course is going to present a lot more problems to them than for children who attend the school but perhaps weren't as close to the horror of it, but are naturally going to be scared. And one of the problems for children is that they're scared of their fears. In other words, they worry that they will be seen as immature, and they feel ashamed if they feel anxious and want their parents to accompany them. But when there's a trauma that occurs to such a large group of people, I think that helps reduce some of that, because it's going to be obvious to all the kids that everyone's scared. So I think anything that parents and the adults around can do to help assuage the fears makes sense. Certainly the children need to know that this is a very, very rare event, they need to know that this person is no longer able to create any damage. The children are going to be taking their cues from the adults. If they see that the adults are able to continue to function in spite of their anxiety, not hiding their anxiety, not pretending that everything is normal, but still being able to get back in the building, people will be surprised at how quickly children can sort of adapt to being back there if they see that the adults are doing that.
Jill, may I ask the doctor a question that's really been kind of plaguing me on this?
Karen, you can ask whatever you like. Go ahead.
Okay. I just read a book, interestingly, called We Have to Talk About Kevin. And I don't know if any of your listeners or any doctor, if you've read it, but it's a fictionalized account of a parent who grows up, who raises a child who ultimately commits a school crime. Okay, and there's no spoiler alert here because you know it happens.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an interesting study because I think a lot of it was probably researched, and it was about the type of kid who does this kind of thing, this kind of disconnected person who maybe has a problem with social cues, not fitting into the norm, kind of an outcast person with maybe some depression issues. I guess I would like the doctor to weigh in on, you know, I understood that he, this 20-year-old had Augsburger's syndrome. I don't know if that's true or not. It's what I read on the internet. And, you know, how would that affect a person in committing this kind of crime, or is there no connection between the two?
I think it's important to recognize that this event is sort of, and what this person did is what we call an outlier event. You know, there are many, many people suffering from all sorts of mental disorders that don't ever come even close to perpetrating any kind of problem like this. So I think it's important that we keep that in mind. I'm real reluctant to speculate on the sort of psychological motivations of this perpetrator, and because we really don't know. In fact, one of the very common things that happens is that when people are interviewed after an event like this, they tend to have what we call a hindsight bias. So they start seeing, they start having memories that conform to a sense for what they would have expected. And so we've come to expect that the description of a gunman who does such a thing is that he was a loner and not understood or bullied in school and all that. And while that is true for some, it's not true for all. And very often what happens is people will report their retrospective memories. Oh, I remember he was this way. But then it turns out when you start sifting through all the data and all the evidence, a very different picture emerges. So I think the best thing is to be careful not to rush to judgment, and in a sense, to handle the questioning about what would have motivated this event the same way that the police handle an investigation, where they just continue to gather clues, they continue to gather information. But I'm concerned because we really don't know what the mental problem was that was associated with, and led up to
this. So, Richard, are you basically saying then let's not even talk about this boy. Let's talk about any school shooter or any shooter. Is there something that triggers that last moment? I mean, it wouldn't necessarily mean that he had a bad childhood and had a horrible life. There was just something that may have triggered him at that moment, coupled with some other sort of the Asperger syndrome, for example. Do you think that's maybe that could be the catalyst in sending the hypothetical shooter out like that?
Well, there would be some catalyst because he wasn't chronically engaging in this kind of behavior, right? So there was some catalyst, but it could be a combination of things. It could also, you wouldn't rule out, for example, biochemical aspects to this. We just don't know, what the catalyst was. We haven't heard enough. I haven't even heard enough about his childhood and his situation. I'm waiting to, and perhaps you all have, or some of your listeners may have seen reports, but I, for example, haven't even seen anything about from the boy's father about
the
his
impression. The only few things that I did hear about the family environment was that he had not spoken to his brother since 2010. and that his parents had been divorced.
Right.
And, you know, that was it. So my mind immediately jumps to, you know, the boy was traumatized from the divorce, and I go through that whole thing and, you know, into our topic that we deal with all the time, and that's what I immediately think of. But then you're hearing that he was, you know, he had the Asperger's, or he had some other sort of depression, or was bipolar. So you hear all kinds of things, and that's precisely why we didn't do this show yesterday, because there was so much reporting going on that was incorrect that you want to try to get the right stuff out there.
Exactly. It's so important. You know, part of this search is really, it's so difficult to accept our feeling that we are really helpless when it comes to these kinds of out-of-the-blue traumas. That's what a trauma is. It's where the with things are just in an instant, or you know, your whole reality is sort of changed. And in trying to deal with that helpless feeling, we try to sort of find the reasons for it so that we can feel some measure of control. Next time we'll be able to predict this. But the reality is that any of these hypotheses, you know, any of the different kinds of mental disorders, there are so many people who suffer from them who would never, ever do anything like this. And so it becomes important, because one of the things we want to avoid is a sort of a stigma that might be associated with if the media mentions Asperger's syndrome or schizophrenia or depression or being withdrawn. We want to make sure that we don't attach a stigma to that or develop expectations or feel like we've got the answer, because clearly
on the other hand, there must be some warning signs in some of these children. I mean, just from my experience doing criminal defense, and again, it could be this retro, you know, looking back and justifying and saying, oh, yes, we knew he was evil because he pulled the whisker off a cat, you know, when he was five. But you do see warning signs along the way with children who become criminals. You see them doing certain things in vandalism and detaching and, you know, becoming very isolated. And, you know, what are the warning signs? What could we look for? What could we see in a child where we could say this child needs help?
First of all, I that's certainly true. That in looking back at these things, you can put together sort of a kind of a psychological autopsy of the situation and kind of piece together what may have happened. The problem, though, is that looking forward, you can have a very, very large group of children who show the same kinds of symptoms, the same kinds of behavior, and only the tiniest, you know, percentage would engage in a violent act like this. So, for example, you can look and see, well, they play video games, but how many millions of children play video games who don't do that? So what you generally look for, first of all, you take seriously if a child is making threats. If a child seems particularly if it's not an age-appropriate thing. So, for example, if a 20-year-old in the last few years has been preoccupied with bombs and explosives or having rages or has changed his functioning in some significant way, you know, sort of dropped out of society, dropped out of contact with the family. I mean, one of the key protections, I think, that we have is for family to try to stay close and try to embrace even those members of the family who seem to be on the fringes, because that keeps them some connected. It keeps someone in tune who could then call for help from authorities or from healthcare personnel if they have something that troubles them. And of course, the family who has spent the most time with the child can detect some differences in the child's behavior that may be too subtle for the rest of us to notice, maybe too subtle for people at work or at school to notice. But the family might be able to put their finger on something that's very, very different.
And then again, Richard, don't you think today's families are a little different? I mean, kids are in so many different things. If they're divorced, you have a mom and a dad trying to make, you know, separate households work. And these kids are sometimes left to be latchkey kids because the parents don't have enough time to spend with them. So those signs and symptoms may all be there, but nobody recognizes them.
And not only this is a good point, and not only though not only that, but that the parents may have such poor communication between
mm-hmm.
themselves. They may each be raising the child in their own home, doing their own thing, and each observing sort of a piece of the puzzle, but because they're not communicating and collaborating more, they're not putting the pieces together. Or they're tending to blame the other parent for symptoms the child is showing instead of taking a different approach of saying, let's try to understand what the problem is.
Right.
So that if a child begins showing problems, it's all your fault, you let him watch too many violent movies and all that, or you coddle him too much, and so the preoccupation of the parents is on blame rather than on recognizing and solving problems. But of course, that's not an inherent aspect of divorce parenting. And many parents after divorce do collaborate well, but then some of them don't. And I do think that's one of the risks for children. Is that they can have a different personality with each parent, and the parents may not sort of recognize that.
Do you think, Richard, that this is going to heighten the awareness for mental health professionals as they treat troubled children that are maybe going through a divorce, post-divorce? Do you think they're going to be looking more for these signs in light of the increase in school shootings and violence?
I think so. In fact, any time there is this sort of event, any time there's a shooting like this, it happened after the shooting in the movie theater with the Dark Knight Rises. That any time that happens, mental health professionals certainly have their awareness heightened. They are more concerned when they hear expressions of violence, when they hear fantasies of violence. Parents, the same. There's an increase in referrals to therapists. A child starts drawing violent pictures, and now the parent doesn't look at it as such an innocent act and is concerned. And, it's better to be proactive. It's better to be overly cautious.
Right.
As long as we're not sort of sending the wrong message to children. But certainly, if you have a concern, it's important to mention it to someone. It's important to look into it, the same as you would with a physical concern. That if you think your child has a physical problem, you don't close your eyes to it and hope it goes away. You find out what's there, and then if you find out that you're overly worried, then you feel relieved after you've been to the doctor. But at least you've done what you can do to protect your children.
Karen, do you have a last question for Dr. Warshak?
Well, I guess I just, I'd like to know his views on the gun issue here. Is there some comment about keeping guns or children with guns? I don't know. I know that most people are pro-guns. In Chicago, we really hold on to our gun ban forever, and now it's been stricken down. But, are there any thoughts on that? I mean, obviously parents shouldn't be keeping their guns in the open with any children, let alone children with difficulties. But I guess I would like the doctor to weigh in on that.
Right. Well, beyond the issue of, the safety issue of guns, as much as I might like to sort of jump into that debate, it really is outside my expertise. I'm not an authority on the constitutional matters. I will say this, though, that it's just one of those reasons that people are searching for now to try to figure out, what can we do to decrease the possibility of this happening in the future. And it makes sense to examine those things, but at the same time, we have to recognize that there's a limit on the control we can have over the future and over these kinds of events. So I'm not going to weigh in on the issue of gun control versus allowing people to have guns more readily so that they could protect against this kind of mass trauma. I think reasonable people can disagree about this, and in fact, and I think it's important that as families we not allow those disagreements to disrupt our functioning, and as a country we not allow those disagreements to keep us from the focus on what do we know that can help children, and let's implement those things.
Richard, thank you. You have been so wonderful to be here with us today, and I know you have another commitment. You are doing great work with children all around the world and the United States and in Dallas where you are, and I thank you for that. And we appreciate your time, and we will keep plugging away at this today. Happy holidays.
Thanks, Jill. I think it's great that you've mobilized so quickly to be able to offer this resource for your listeners.
thanks, Richard, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Take care, Doctor.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Karen, we have with us Dr. Rebecca Bailey, who is a friend from California, and you might remember, Karen, she was J.C. Dugard's therapist, J.C. who was kept in a backyard for many, many years. And Rebecca's here. Hi, Rebecca.
Hello, how are you?
I'm great. Karen Conti is here with us. She's an attorney from Chicago, good friend, and she is co-hosting with me today, and so I want to introduce the two of you. There you go.
Hello.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
Rebecca, we have just spoken with Dr. Richard Warshak, who you know from Dallas-Fort Worth, and we were getting his views on the school shooting that happened yesterday in Connecticut. And I talked to you this morning, and you said you'd be more than happy to come on and tell us what you thought about these issues. And we just kind of wrapped up talking about the mind of the shooter and what, you know, what. And not necessarily this particular shooter, because we don't know everything about this boy yet and what happened, what he went through. Not that that matters, because he did a heinous thing yesterday. And what we'd like to know from you is, what do you think happens with these kids who decide to go in and kill other people, their own parents? What makes this happen?
Well, as you know, and I don't know, you know, what listeners know, my real focus is on reunification and working with helping support the resiliency and the connections within families. I certainly have some understanding of what we call way off the bell curve behavior, but I don't in any way consider myself an absolute expert in it. I like to continue my simplistic focus on the absolute importance of slowing down, paying attention, communication, and understanding when these absolute, absolute terrible tragedies happen, that the part of the issue with them is that they're so far out of our scope of normal understanding. This very, very, very sad situation brought to mind, I believe it was the Sweden case with that man, the young shooter they killed, was it 75? And
no,
75 people. And, you know, looking at him, we're still scratching our head and saying, what happened here? What was that? So, you know, it would be so nice if we could say, oh, this is the cause, this is the reason. But what we know over and over as a world, as a community, as human beings, we need to slow down, pay attention to each other, and pay attention to the connections between all of us. The very little I know about this case is that, you know, this young man was an outlier. He was perceived to be an introvert. He was perceived to be on the outside. And, you know, could this have been prevented by some intervention early on? I hope we come to some of those conclusions.
Go ahead, Rebecca.
Over the generations, if I could butt in, this is Ian Williams.
Ian Williams is coming in. He's a UN correspondent, and Ian is the newest contributor to Syndicated News. Hi, Ian. We're with Dr. Rebecca Bailey and Karen Conti.
Yes.
Hi, Ian.
Hello.
Hi, Ian.
I mean, we've got to consider not just the intention. Look, lots of us have had sort of, we've been frustrated and we've been angry, and you have murderous impulses, and you start sort of thinking of what you would like to see happen to your enemies. The problem is that modern technology provides the means to actually act out those fantasies. If the country weren't awash with weaponry that can mow down hundreds of people, freely available almost, then this isn't possible. You know, you can have your tantrum. There's almost this week, there's been a similar incident in China where somebody went with a knife, but nobody died because there's a limit to what you can do with a knife. But with the type of sort of high-octane, high-megaton weaponry that the National Rifle Association insists should be made freely available with less checks, by the way, than people driving a vehicle, then you have opportunity here, plus a lot of people out there of dubious sanity and balance. It's a situation that's going to happen. The one in Norway it was, by the way.
No, I'm sorry. I knew I was getting it wrong. Thank you, Ian. I appreciate Norway.
I mean, he was a religious fanatic. He was a Christian white religious fanatic who'd been building up these plots for a long time and storing up weaponry. But that was a complete aberration, whereas I think the point that people, that President Obama was making is there's been too many of these incidents from Columbine to this over and over again. And yet, no congressman is prepared to risk his neck in the teeth of the National Rifle Association and get up and say, this is wrong. At the very least, guns should be controlled. Nobody is saying that it should be banned. Britain did that, by the way, and I oppose that because it went too far. But they should be strictly controlled. The amount of ammunition and weaponry that's around freely available is in a country with as many unstable people wandering the streets, it's a massacre waiting to happen.
You know, I think another piece that's a little bit out of a segue from what Ian was just saying is the importance as parents right now with children to really listen to them, to really support them and understand that this is profoundly impacting our children. I had a call from a 16-year-old last night and who happened to be my daughter who was just at a friend's house and just in deep, deep despair. And was telling me how she felt so anxious and felt like she didn't feel safe anymore. And, you know, really what I needed to do with her was just reassure her. At the same time, I understand what Ian's saying, and certainly there have been one is way too many, absolutely. But as parents and, you know, with the many of our, you know, families where kids live in two different houses, et cetera, sometimes we think the other parent is doing it. Have the conversations. Make sure you talk with these guys. Let them know that it's bad. Let them know that you hear it, that you know that it affects them.
Well, I have to disagree, respectfully disagree with Ian on the gun control issue. I mean, I think if these kids want guns or these people that are shooting, and it's not always kids, they're going to get their gun. Responsible people who have guns, have the proper licensing, have the proper training, know what to do with a gun. And, I mean, I'm a concealed carry permit holder in several states, and I have to tell you,
when I'm saying gun control, I am not talking about abolition. I am talking about control and regulation. And we have a situation where...
But, Ian, we have control and regulation
now. It takes about 30 seconds to get a shotgun permit in upstate New York. You put your driving license in, and the permit comes right back. In Britain, if you wanted a gun when you still could, you had to go into the police station, you registered, they did background checks on you, they found out if anything was known. They had an opportunity to raise objections to issuing a gun license to you. And we very rarely got these type of incidents. And when they did happen, I think the government overreacted and introduced prohibition completely. The British pistol team, by the way, for the Olympics had to fly to Belgium to practice. They weren't allowed to practice in their own country. So
Rebecca for a few more minutes, so I've got to get back to the mental health aspect of this for a second, because I think Rebecca would say, just like Richard, that guns aren't her forte, right, Rebecca?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a fascinating subject, and like any other person, I'm interested in, may or may not have my own viewpoints on it, but absolutely, it's not my forte.
I have a question for Dr. One, and this is one that no one is talking about, but it happened to be in this book that I was telling you that I read called We Have to Talk About Kevin, because it's written by a parent, a fictional parent, who raised a child who ended up doing something really bad in the school shooting. And the idea was, what could she see it coming, and the guilt and the problems that she had relating to that. So, I mean, we have so many victims here, but we hardly ever focus on the parents. Here we have a mother who's dead, the father's still alive. What do they go through? I mean,
I think, I was saying to somebody this morning that in some ways, and this is a horrible thing to say, but in some ways the cruelest thing he could have done was keep his mother alive after this action. I think you're absolutely right. Every parent understands and can identify with the questions that you must be asking yourself and wrestling with. I frequently have parents of children that contact me who may have an introverted child, and frequently there is a fear that, oh my goodness, how do I know my kid isn't going to do this? I still say, as a community, as a world, we do need to really slow down, listen to each other, pay attention to each other. It's over and over again. I used to work in a dual diagnosis team many years ago, and dual diagnosis, as most of you probably know, is when you work with major mental illnesses and drug addiction. And back in the day, I'm talking 28 years ago, I used to have no fear of going out into the streets or going into these folks' houses. This day and age, I wouldn't do it. And I ask myself all the time, you know, what is the variable here? How have we become a society? And, you know, gun control is one issue. We've got all these other variables. But what is it that has taken... It used to be that being afraid of people with mental illness was something you just would tell each other as a professional, you know, you don't have to be afraid. And now the questions have to come up.
Rebecca, don't you think, Rebecca, though, if you look at over the last 20, 25 years, the drastic change that has happened in America with the nuclear family, the advent of, and I hate to say it, these video games and kids not playing outside and nobody eating at the same dinner table and all of the things that have changed since we were kids go ahead.
As a reunification person who my whole focus is on helping whatever family connect, I absolutely do. And the family, the nuclear family may look different and people's families may be composed of people that are not – you know, genetically related in a way bigger way. But I'm with you, Jill. We've got to slow down. We've got to look for connection. We've got to really, as a society, refocus back on that issue over and over and over, which is just really paying attention. I don't know if these parents were the most attentive parents in the world. I don't at all want to sound like I'm poking and, you know, pointing fingers at them. I can't even imagine the questions that this father has to be asking himself right now. Absolutely.
I think we know that kids are not resilient through divorce, and whether this kid had issues that were never treated, we don't know any of that. We'll see that soon. You know, but I think we've got to do exactly what you said. And it may sound too simplistic to say we need to go back and take the family back to where it was 30 years ago and not have our kids in so many different activities and pay attention to what's going on in their lives and listen to them.
Jill, you know, with me, you're preaching to the choir on that one.
Yep.
You know, last night I was in the middle of a huge intervention with a family that we're working with this weekend, and my daughter called, and I had to stop everything for an hour. And I don't mean I had to. I was delighted
you
to
wanted
do it.
To. Right.
But it was really important, and I stayed with her, you know, until she was ready to let go and, you know, hang up and go be with her buddy and relax. But that's right, Jill. I'm a duck simpleton, so I'm with you.
Well, I appreciate you being on, Rebecca, and we will we'll talk soon. You call me this week. We thank you, Karen, and I thank you so much for being here.
Thank you
You're welcome.
And I appreciate you doing this as well. Thank you.
We'll
thank you
again.
For meeting as well.
Take care. Bye, Ian.
Bye,
Karen. Bye, Jill.
Bye. Well, and we've got some people on, more people on the line from Connecticut that we're going to talk to in just a second. But Ian, you know, I'm interested in your thoughts about the gun issues very much, and I think that coming from me, I mean, I am a big proponent of guns. I love to shoot. I love to use them as a recreational tool.
I was a member of a pistol club back home in Liverpool.
Yeah.
I've got no problem with guns, but I do think that if you insist that people have to pass a test to get a driver's license, if they need checks to see that they can see, they can hear, and they can function, and that they're not, that they don't have a record of criminality and antisociability in terms of driving, then the very least is that you can regulate the use of guns. And the problem is we have a lobby which has confused prohibition with control and regulation. And guns are lethal weapons, and they need control and regulation. And they need tracking so that, you know, there have been some ingenious suggestions, you know, that ammunition should be made so it's sort of decomposable. You have to renew it at regular intervals. So people can't stockpile. There's lots of imaginative suggestions, and this is all put up there. But the gun lobby kills more people every year than Al-Qaeda. Many more people by its actions. Far, far more people are killed in this way. And yet congressmen who will stand up there, commit billions and trillions of dollars to a war on, quote, terror, unquote, will quail and run for cover if they are asked to support not the abolition of guns, but regulation, asking that lunatics do not get guns. The people have to prove that they are not criminally insane when they get.
Karen, you have a comment?
The law, wrong.
Sure. Go ahead, Karen.
I'm sorry, Jill.
I said, do you have a comment on that?
You know, I am really compromised on this issue, Jill. As you know, I live in Chicago, and I have a home in the country of central Illinois. When I go down to my home in central Illinois, everybody has a gun, and I don't have a problem with that. We all kind of know who we are. We know that there are hunters there. We know they're carrying their guns on their gun racks. Guns are an accepted way of life. When I'm in the city, I don't like guns. I don't want somebody on the L to have a gun. I don't know people on the L. I don't know who the stranger is next to me. And I'm really going to have a hard time believing that if everybody has guns, we're going to be safer. I mean, I could be wrong, and I think I'm going to have to see this, because I think that the way the law is and the way the Supreme Court has come down, we're all going to be able to carry a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we are going to be safer, and maybe I'm going to, you know, join the team, and I'm going to have one in my office, because I'll, you know, you've got crazy people and clients and people who feel disenfranchised might come and try to do something to me, and maybe I'll feel more safe. But I don't know. I'm trying to keep my mind open on it, but I don't think I like knowing that everybody on my train has a gun and they're packing it. And I don't know. And that could be just growing up in a community that didn't have guns. I'm not used to it.
I do agree that
we should have training. And I do agree that there is a confusion between banning guns and getting trained for guns. I mean, I would think the people who I know who are responsible with guns, who love their guns, who are good gun people, have their gun safe, they get training, they go out to the range, they don't have any problem doing that because they know that's the right thing to do.
Right.
It's the people that buy the gun and don't know how to use it and keep it out so their kids can find it. I mean, those are the people we have to really be concerned about.
You're right. All right, well, we've got some people on the line. Jennifer Verinault is on the line from Connecticut. Jennifer, are you here?
I am, Jill.
Hi, Jennifer. You're with Karen and Ian and I, and we're just going to wrap up our hour here. The lines will stay open after this so people can still call in, still talk about their grief or any issues that they have relating to this school shooting. But you are right there, just like Jeff Overman, who was on earlier. And I wanted to just get your thoughts on what the scene is like now. What is the aura in that area? You were in Newtown today delivering food. You and your husband have put together a great thing. So talk about that a little bit.
Well, we went to Newtown, and it was just very emotional. And we actually arrived at one of the grief centers at Reed Intermediate School in Newtown to deliver the food. We didn't know where to bring it. We just said, you know what, we're going to go and we'll find a place. And we went to the church, and the priest said, go to the Reed Intermediate School, and they have some grief counselors there. We went there. It was a great location to drop off some food. There were a lot of tears, a lot of people. We had a group of cheerleaders that brought some food from Newtown. Governor Malloy had just pulled in. We met a therapy dog, a guy that came from Saratoga, New York, I think that's what it was, to bring his therapy dog down, and it was very emotional. One thing they did say is that, you know, as the weeks go by, they're going to need more support and food because of all the families that have been touched by this. Touched is not the right word. I guess devastated by it. And it was very emotional, Jill.
And Jennifer, what you and Jerry put together, you are taking donations to bring food trays to the grief-stricken families, right?
Yes. We teamed up with a great market in Darien, Connecticut, which is not too far away from Newtown. It's Darien Market and Palmer's Market, and Cindy Palmer has been so great as to organize this with us. And if anyone would like to call the store between now and Wednesday, and whether it's $5 or $20 or whatever they want to donate, we will bring the food on Wednesday, which is actually going to be really emotional because that's when the funerals are starting, we were told today. So we'll bring hot food for them, and they're going to distribute it to the family. So when they go home that evening, they don't have to worry about any food. And, of course, there's many organizations that are out there, but we just felt like, you know what, we're going to go there and we're going to actually hand it right over. And, you know, we know it's going right there to them.
Good. Karen,
anyone
do you have any questions for Jennifer?
I'm sorry?
I was going to ask if Karen had any questions for you, Jennifer.
Okay.
No, I don't, and I think it's just probably too soon to even understand what people need, but I'm glad there are people there who are helping out. It makes us all feel good about our community.
Yeah, it is so raw and so new that the American Red Cross woman, Leslie, who started tearing, I mean, she just started bawling and she's just crying with us. We were hugging, and she said, we don't even have anyone to actually organize the food that's going to come in, you know. So I don't work on Wednesday, so I said, I will be here at 6 o'clock on Wednesday morning, and we will figure it out if it's not figured out by then. But if anyone would like to call Palmer's Market, I'd love to give the phone number, and then they can call. And just, again, if it's $5 or $10, it doesn't matter, whatever they would like to donate.
What's the number, Jennifer?
203-655-2077. Again, it's Palmer's Market in Darien, Connecticut, and they could just say it's part of the Mastrangelo food donation.
Okay. Mastrangelo food donation. Of course, that's Jerry, your husband, and he has three triplets that he hasn't seen in some years, and we're working on that, aren't we?
We are. And Jerry's on the phone, so if he wants to say hello, he did see one of his sons.
Hi, Jill.
Hey, Jerry. How's it going there?
It's going okay, and I was saddened by so many other people throughout the country and watching the news and seeing all the sadness. I decided to pick up the phone and try to see my children, and excuse me, and I did have the opportunity to see one of them and give him a big hug and reassure him how much I love him and miss him, and it was a really nice feeling.
Oh, that's terrific. But, you know, the first thing I thought of, and I didn't want this show to be about parental alienation, but the first thing I thought of, out of all those 800 kids that were in that school, one of or more of those kids is alienated from a parent, and there's a parent out there who doesn't know if his child is living or dead right now.
Yeah.
And that was sad, coupled with everything else that was happening. I thought, there's some parent somewhere in America who doesn't know. You know, so that's something that alienated parents go through every day, and it certainly can't compare to the grief of a deceased child. And this is just a tragedy,
and we applaud both you and Jennifer for doing what you're doing for the grief-stricken families.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jill.
And can I say something, Jill? You
sure,
know,
Jennifer.
Like Jeff has said to us, Jeff Opperman, he was so kind as to leave a message for us a couple months ago, and when Jerry's father passed and all that, you know, alienators don't take a day off, he said, and I agree with that. And when Jerry reached out to the mother, the alienator, yesterday to say, listen, I want to see my three children. I want to give them a hug and tell them how much I love them no matter what's going on. She could not seem to get past anything. She could only deliver one of the three children, and it's just a very sad thing, very sad.
Yeah. It really is. Well, I appreciate you two being here, and we're going to sign off with you for now. We're
okay.
going to say our final goodbye, and Ruth, you'll be on the rest of the day with everybody, Ruthie and Ian. So thank you, Jerry and Jennifer, and if there's anything we can do, please let us know.
Thank
okay.
you.
Thanks, Jill.
God bless.
Okay,
okay
guys.
Thanks, Jill. Bye-bye.
Karen and Ian, we're going to wrap it up now, and I know Ruthie is on, and she's going to stay on the rest of the day. So, thank you, Karen, for being here. Appreciate
okay.
it. Are you there?
Thank you for me as well.
Thank you, Ian. You are wonderful, and I love to have this great banter about. We should do a whole show about this. You know.
Yes.
About guns. So I'll talk to you soon, I hope. And Karen, thanks so much.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Bye, bye, Ian. Well, I just wanted to say thank you to everybody for listening, and please just. Keep these families in your prayers, and I know you're going to do a great job for the next couple of hours fielding calls and appreciate what you did here today to make this happen.
And you are so welcome, and don't worry, we're going to soothe some people because they're asking for music as well, some Christmas carols. They feel they need that because they're actually here to grieve, and
yeah.
I'm touched that they came, even if only for that. I think it's just lovely.
Well, I'll be talking with you two, with you and Ian soon, and looking forward to it, and thank you for all you do.
And it's very interesting. I think we should do a gun rights and gun control discussion. That would be a very interesting discussion.
It would be. It would definitely would be, and you'll get all kinds of different opinions, pro and con, and some that are going to be, you know, fervent gun control, for fervent gun control, and some that are going to be so far the other way, you know, it'll just make your socks pop off. So,
well,
it would be
I'll tell you right now, for those of you who are interested, we have an anti-gun advocate who will be here, an attorney who fights this tooth and nail, even at the Supreme Court level, and we will also have a representative from the NRA. So it
wow.
will be a lively discussion.
Well, we'll talk soon, and I just thank you for doing this. It was great.
Thank you. Thank you for hosting. I so
right.
appreciate you.
Thank
I'll
you. Talk to you soon. Thanks, Ricky. Bye-bye.
Well, we're here at syndicatednews.net, and we're basically going to offer questions and answers if you need them. We're going to offer music if you need music to soothe the soul, or if you need to ask questions. We've been collecting information from the police departments in Newtown, Connecticut. And they have been very, very cooperative and helpful to media. And they've begun releasing photographs and names. Many families have also released photographs, which is why we have that beautiful angels picture on syndicatednews.net. And if anyone would like to join us here inside the studio, the phone number in New York City is 347-539-5024. If you're outside of New York City, the phone number is 877-921-5489. It's a toll-free number. Feel free to dial in and ask any question. What we don't know, we'll find out for you, or express your opinion. Tell us how you feel about this tragedy and what's happened in Connecticut. Or even gun control. Did you see how that conversation immediately erupted into a pro-gun and anti-gun discussion. We're going to have a discussion about gun control and pro-gun lobbyists from the NRA will join us as well. So we'll have both sides of the panel. We'll have that soon. We'll announce it all over the internet on Facebook, on syndicatednews.net. And in the meanwhile, because it's a, how would I say, a sad situation, while we wait for callers, and we have also callers and questions that are coming in from Facebook and, oh my goodness, MSN and from other online programs, we're going to play a little Christmas wish song for you. It's by Sean Ray, Christmas Wishes. And here we are.
If I had my way this Christmas, if all I would wish could be, of all the great wishes in a wonderful world, I'd only ask for three. And if I could have three wishes, and if my first wish came true, there'd be peace on earth, goodwill among men, and love in all that we do. Can you imagine a world like that? What a wonderful would be. Then I would wish it could go on forever for people like you and me. If I had my way this Christmas, and if the two others came through, my third wish would be for now and forever to share all my wishes with you. Can you imagine a world like that? What a wonderful world it would be. And then
that keeps coming up again and again is the motivation behind the shooting. The fact that the youngster was 20 years old and He apparently suffers from Asperger's, which is actually a high-functioning form of autism. It could be an influential factor. It may not. But that he was very shy, did not familiarize himself with people at school. There was barely a photo of him anywhere on the internet. Shows that he was a person that had already isolated himself. He felt quite isolated. And may she also rest in peace, but his mother was extremely demanding. She was she had very high expectations for him, as she had for her other son. Her other son is successful. He works at Ernst & Young. He's graduated college. He's done well for himself. And he spent all of the day on Facebook saying, it wasn't me, it wasn't me. I was at work. Imagine the horror he must be experiencing as the sibling. And my heart goes out to those families who were at home or at work, went to pick up their babies, and that's what they were. They were babies. They were not kids. And would come home without a baby that day. You cannot imagine. We can't begin to say, I know how you feel. We can't know how that person feels unless we've experienced that sorrow, that loss. Huh? Google again. The family, yes, I'm going to repeat the question and answer because it's come in again. And the question is about the family. The family was divorced. The father and mother were divorced for several years. And actually, here's our chaplain who's joining us from La Jolla, California. Chaplain?
Yes, how are you?
How are you? Welcome to syndicatednews.net. I was thinking that a chaplain might be exactly what we need to make me, basically to help us make some sense of this and maybe help us through the grieving process. What are your recommendations?
Well, it's a tough tragedy, you know, for everyone involved, you know, the family, the police, the responders, the parents. There's tons of guilt of the people who tried to do something and they couldn't. So, you know, from my training in a hospital, you know,
tell us what hospital you were. It's good to know.
It's with us. It's Scripps La Jolla in San Diego, California. You can Google it.
We know the hospital. Thank you so much for joining us. We're very interested in your point of view. Please lead us, basically.
Well, you know, part of the training, you know, and I can only tell you from my experience, you know, we went through a lot of crisis management as being part of a hospital in case a situation like this happened. And many of the hospitals, they practice and they rehearse and they rehearse for, you know, terrible things just like this. So it's very difficult, but, you know, as a first responder, being a chaplain is a little bit different than everyone else because, you know, people, once they come down from it, you know, they're mad at God. It's very common for people to be upset with God because good people, innocent people, you know, had to pass away. The really kicker about this and why this is different than all the other tragedies or self-killings that people do is that, you know, innocent kids that were 6 years of age were involved. When adults are involved, they're like the college shooting. You know, it's still tough for everyone, but when innocent kids, so that just multiplies the crisis and the trauma that people go through. So one of the first things that I was taught and what I do is when you respond to a scene like that is, you know, you have to separate people, but you're seeing that what's happening now on some of the interviews with the parents is when you're in crisis like that, you have a physical reaction. It's a physiological reaction where one half of your brain basically doesn't work, and the other side works. It's all the emotional side, but the thought process, analyzation, and problem solving part of your brain can't work, and you're numb. And it's described by many people over the years of being numb. And it's happened to everyone, especially when you've heard of if someone's been very, very close to you and they've passed away, you're numb for a week, 2 weeks, and then you start coming down. So, you know, helping children 6 years of age, the process of crisis intervention is different than that with an adult. I heard some people.
What is the difference? What is the difference? Could you teach us what the difference is between crisis intervention for adults versus crisis intervention for children?
Yes. Well, with children, they don't understand, especially at that age or even at 6 years or 10 years or 12 years of age, they don't understand death or a loss like adults would. And I'm not saying adults understand. But adults, once we leave a certain age, we process our problems, our stuff differently. Kids at that age, they don't understand what a gun is. They don't understand, you know, the development that you've gone through as an adult all your life to do problem solving. So in a situation like this, you know, the kids might not have known what was going on. They might not have been afraid. Even though it's a horrifying story to you and I. So what happens when children are that young, you know, they can't verbalize. They can't come up with the phonics that you and I can come up with, especially like in a chaplain situation. You want people to grieve. You want people to tell their story. You want to be a listener. Children can't come up with the vocabulary. So at that age, the best thing to do with children, and maybe not right away, but in therapy that they should start, is you get kids that age to draw pictures. And from the pictures, and whether it's a cartoon, whether it's whatever picture, that's where the therapist starts. Okay, so so to answer your question, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm waiting for you. Please go ahead. This is highly important and very interesting and instructive. Many of us do not know what you're teaching us.
Okay. I'm sorry. I apologize because I thought he was asking a question. But so in the short run, okay, you know, kids, some of them, they might not know what's going on, but they're judging the trauma and the fear by the way their parents go through it. So you know, the parents have to be real cognizant of the way that they react to stress, trauma, because the child will see them reacting. And that's not saying if parents are scared or crying, it's a bad thing. But some parents have to just be conscientious because the child at that young of an age, at 6 years of age, will copy the parent. Like I said before, you know, the kids react differently to crisis, to stress, and it's usually, you know, what I've been taught is, you know, they have to start drawing. They communicate through drawing. They don't communicate, you know, through words. The other thing is whenever anyone goes through something like this, whether it's the police officers, whether it's me here in San Diego and I'm in shock, it takes some time because there's a lot of confusion that's happening. And really, the people shouldn't start counseling. Well, what can I say? I don't want to say it wrong. They should allow whenever a death or grief happens, it's usually good to start counseling a couple weeks out when that numbness starts to reside. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Because when you're in that zone, when you're in the area of crisis management and only half your brain is working, and that could happen for, you know, a couple of days, that could happen for a couple of weeks. It's only when you start getting back to normal and grieving properly that your body starts to function, and then you can look for help and an advice. When I first got in the hospital chaplaincy, that's what my mentor told me, and it turned out to be true, because for the first couple days here, you know, there shouldn't be any psychoanalysis. You know, there should be crisis care, crisis management, but nothing, you know, textual out of a book. The main thing you want the parents to do, and as a crisis manager, sometimes it's difficult because we all want to know what happened. We all want to know the specifics, why he did it, how he got into the school, did he drive there, you know. So there's a lot of questions that really in the long run doesn't matter. But what you want to get the victims and the parents and the people who were right there and real close to it is just to tell their story. And once you get them to tell their story and they get it off their chest and they verbalize their feelings, even if they're crying, that's when the healing starts. So in many situations, within 24 hours, the first responders, the policemen, the sheriff, the parents, they should have a crisis management meeting where 30 or 40 people sit around in a group and they line the chairs around and they ask each person, you know, what happened? And each person tells their story, and just through them telling their story, and I'm trying to keep it simple, that's where the healing begins, because people like to clam up. People, especially when they come upon graphic or very traumatic injuries, like police officers, ambulance workers, where they see a lot of blood and human remains, that intensifies more. And so you want to get the person to, you know, be in a comfortable environment so they know they're safe, and then get them to open up and tell their story. And that's where the healing, you know, begins. Further down the line, you know, I would have to refer them out to someone more specialized, you know, a couple weeks down the line, or, you know, to a psychiatrist or someone else within my field, because, you know, if it's too much for me, I have to recommend out. You know, I have to, the word for it is farming out to a specialist. So, you know, from my experience, my crisis management experience as a chaplain, you're the first one on the scene, and you just want to make sure everyone's safe, but that also, you know, people can tell their story. And that's really the only thing you can do. Within the first couple of days, especially with the media, and it was very similar to after 9/11, you know, everything stopped around the country for a couple of days. Everything stopped because people were numb. People were in shock. Well, like I said earlier, this one's tougher because six-year-old kids, innocent kids, were involved. So,
of the children were in the first grade and aged six. That's what the police officer, the coroner stated this morning when he gave his report. And I wanted to know, of your training, of this training management that you've had, this is wonderful because you have, it has to be handled in such a delicate fashion. I mean, it's not something that one can take lightly.
Well, there's actually training, and you can Google it. It's called Crisis Incident Stress Management, CISM. They travel around the country, and for $400 or $500, and any healthcare profession can get their employer to pay for it, they teach this basic introductory class over a three-day period of crisis management and how to deal with this. So that training anyone can get. But I also wanted to touch on the spiritual aspect, if I could. Because
do, Chaplain, because at this point, we so need that. I'm not a highly spiritual person per se, but there are many people who are, and right now they're very angry at God. They're wondering, how did God let this happen? And I was looking around Facebook this afternoon, and I came across a sign that someone posted where a child or someone was pleading to God, saying, God, how could you let this happen in our schools? And the response, I guess they were stating, they were responding from God, well, actually, they locked me out of schools. I can't go to schools anymore. And it was such a jolt. It's true. We've removed God and anything, I guess, spiritual from schools and federal buildings. Can you help us through this, Chaplain, and guide us through it?
Yes. I can go a couple different directions with the answer, but let me just think this. As a chaplain, you know, my job is not necessarily to answer questions when someone is in crisis. You know, for example, with all the people, you know, they might ask me that question, but we call it in pastoral care, you never catch the ball. Because the real healing comes from that person coming up with their own answer. And I have people in my field, okay, that will automatically start going to the Bible verses. Now, I'm a Christian. I'm a Christian. Okay, I'm a Christian. Okay, but I'm very trained not to force my view on anyone else, especially someone in crisis, because people are vulnerable. People are vulnerable right now. And they're mad at God, so they need to express it. So, you know, part of my answer, one half of my answer here is going to be my training is basically I turn that question that you have back to you because it's really your meaning is more important than mine. Okay? The other part of the answer is just going to, you know, to theology and stuff. There's been stuff like this in the Bible. In the Bible, you can prove by archaeological evidence of all these terrible things happening. And God loved us so much that he gave us free will. Well, with that free will comes people who do bad things. and in that free will, so we're not walking around like robots. God wants us to enjoy life. These things happen, number one. Number two, you know, there's evil in the world. I can't say it any simpler. There's evil in the world. Sometimes it comes through people. Sometimes it comes through situations. But there's evil in the world, and people just have to be cognizant of that. And so, you know, without me spitting out Bible verses and telling you, you know, what Jesus said, just know that, you know, in this world, you know, even in the Bible, it never said Christians or good people would have an easy time at life. Life has never been fair. No one's ever told me that, or I've heard it, but life has never been fair. And then the other part of the question is, I can't give any answers either. I don't know why. I don't know why God would do. I'm not blaming on God, okay, because God isn't responsible for this. God is in, you know, God is in the teacher, the principal who gave her life and tried to stop her that ran out of the classroom. God is in all the people who rushed there, all the doctors who were waiting at the hospital, you know, so I can also reframe it and see where there's blessings in this, but it's just very, very tough to introduce God or any type of Bible verses because, you know, people are hurting, and when people are hurting, when they're having this physical reaction, other people shouldn't take advantage of them. And I've been to sites and I've had training where people would say things like, hey, if you had God in your life, this wouldn't happen. No, that's not true. Or they'll spit out a cliche. like they'll say, well, you know, God has a purpose for this in your life. He's going to use it for you. Well, no, that's not true either. Another cliche is, you know, everything will be okay. It's in God's hands. Well, no, that doesn't work either. So to answer your question, I could answer it several different ways, but just know that from my history, my experience, there isn't a God up there with the magic wand saying, hey, okay, evil's going to happen here. You know, just because he permits it doesn't mean he necessarily allows it. So I'll throw
and
it
I
back
wanted
at
to, I wanted to ask you, because it's going to come up again and again in this small town, what is the most respectful way that an individual who doesn't have your training, for instance, myself, I don't have your training, I don't know how to approach a family, what is the correct and respectful method that one could speak to an individual who has just lost a baby, a six-year-old baby? Is there a way that one can embrace them, and what is the right thing to do? Teach us, please, because people like myself, we don't know.
Well,
I'm not being flip. I'm asking sincerely. I'm asking
that's
sincerely.
That's fine. I can help you. I can help you, or I can try to help you. One of the things you don't say is you don't say, I know how you feel. Because very many times if you went through a divorce and then your friend was going through a divorce, you say, well, I know how you feel. I went through the same thing. No one knows how to feel. So when you offer your condolences and you say, I'm very, very, very sorry for your loss, I don't know how you feel. And then let the conversation go. And just remember that a lot of times, even in our conversations, that doesn't have to do with grief or trauma, you know, people always talk about themselves. And they always say, I, me. Your job as a chaplain, as someone with remorse that's just lost, that your neighbor just lost her mother, they just lost their husband, what you want to do is just let the person talk. And silence is really the key, because most people, when they talk around the country, they're always talking about themselves or their situation or me, I. Listen to the conversations, you know, with all your friends in the next couple of days, and you'll see that all the conversations, you'll go to parties or Christmas parties, people are battling over the conversation. In pastoral care, you don't want to do that. You just want to express your condolences.
Yes.
You want to be present with them, and you don't want to say too much. And you can say things like, well, how do you feel? Is there, you know, can you please describe, you know, what happened? That's what usually worked with me, is I would walk in and I would, you know, express my condolences, and I would say, what happened? And then through the different stories or whatnot, I would just let the person talk and grieve, and it was more about me being present than it was about me saying things. Because people are in that state of shock. They're in that mind frame where what you're going to counsel them with isn't going to make sense to them anyways. But you just want to be there for them. And also you want to continue to be there for them after the funeral or after the ceremony, because many times people are afraid of death. They don't want to talk about it. And a month after the person dies, all of a sudden all their friends go away, and 2 or 3 months down the line, they're all alone. So you want to keep in contact with someone and just express your condolences and be with them and not say too much. Does that make sense?
It sure does, and I'm asking you these questions because it's coming up again and again in Instant Messenger and Google and on Facebook, and they're asking questions that I thought I can't even apply them to myself, because I wouldn't know how to behave or what to say. And what happens, what most of us do is we just avoid the situation altogether and go travel because we can't face it because we know we're not equipped. And rather than make a mistake and say something horrific, we'd rather not even take the risk of making a mistake, so we say nothing and we remain silent.
Right. That's very common, and that happens all the time. And that's a normal reaction, actually, to grief. That's a normal reaction because people don't know what to say, so they say nothing. It's, and that's good and bad. The bad part is that, you know, you as a friend want to say something, and you really can't say it because you're afraid of saying something bad. Or you're afraid of saying something that will hurt them more.
Yes, something
but
awkward.
There is something, but I just want to say for everyone else that's listening out there, it's normal because you don't know what to say. But don't let that not knowing what to say, being afraid, from you reaching out to someone. Because what the person wants more is that your presence. You know, I used to get calls all the time from the hospital in the middle of the night. And I had this beeper. And it used to go off at all night. And what would happen is if someone got into an accident or someone died late at night,
yes,
and they wanted a chaplain to come in,
yes,
to say prayers, that was very common. And when I would get in there, many of the times, I wouldn't know what to say. But I would sit down with the family and just talk with them and not necessarily talk about passing away, but also talking about the good parts of the person. Because like yourself, people who have this crisis, they clam up too and they don't say anything. So you want to get them to express their feelings, talk good things about the deceased, and basically be a good listener. So you don't have, so the good thing about what your issue is that you don't have to say anything, you just have to be present. But many people, when they get into situations, they don't know what to say, they drop cliches, but just knowing that you have that issue should not stop you from reaching out to people. Okay?
And by the way, in case I know my friends and relatives are listening and saying, oh, it's the ice queen, of course, she doesn't feel. On the contrary, when I got out of college, one of my first jobs was as a first responder, but not in taking care of individuals. I worked for insurance companies, and I would photograph crime scenes. And when you've photographed crime scenes, it does affect how you react to tragedy. And you cannot go and remark and gasp and cry or scream or show any amount of emotion because sometimes at that crime scene, there are still relatives present. So you have to go and do the work. And it seems very cold to a relative who's just lost a loved one when you're there in the capacity of taking photographs of something, someone that they love, they've had a tremendous loss, and you're there in a technical capacity only. And we were not allowed to express grief or upset or actually, I wouldn't at the moment. I would leave, and on the way home, I would absolutely sometimes just fall apart. But at the moment, while we were assuming the responsibility of collecting the photography, we could not express emotion. And it became very easy for me not to express emotion in trying to be very careful not to say the wrong thing or be seen as an emotional, high-strung person. I wanted to be seen as a professional who went, took the photographs, and left. And I got pretty good at it, but yes, it does affect you in the long term. And I stopped going to funerals. It became too difficult for me. And I would like to learn how to be tender. And I'd like if you could teach me and the other listeners how we can approach a family in a respectful manner and be tender. I guess what you're saying is to be there, be present, and just listen. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's. I mean, without giving you a three chapters to read tonight and to learn from a book, yes, it's just being present, being there, asking them if there's anything they need, and just letting them vent.
Chaplain, you don't realize how important your presence is here right now. We have sitting live in the room 475 people listening to your words. So I'm not the only one who's asking, and the majority of the questions I've received has been, what is the reaction that I should have when I approach? Two of the people are from that town, and the reason they didn't want to come on the air is because obviously their voices would be recognized, but their questions were similar. The one doesn't know that the other one was calling, but the questions were the same. How do I approach my neighbor who just lost a baby? How do I approach my other coworker's family? They just lost one coworker, one teacher is alive, and she's experiencing a sense of guilt for having survived.
Right.
You are so welcome. I can't thank you enough for having called, because at this moment, we need a chaplain more than we need anything else. Your opinion is highly valued here.
Well, it's funny because I was a chaplain not because of, that I would, have all the answers. I did it to help people because, I have a giving heart and, I've always wanted to help people. And it's a specialized type of training, okay? So I'm just tickled pink, and I find glory in God that God would give me the tools, like He gives everyone tools to help others. And so I'm torn back too by the emotion of it. But one of the things I used to always do as a chaplain is I wouldn't be emotionally absent. I wouldn't build that wall like you built that wall when you were a crime scene reporter taking pictures, because you had to. So you have probably developed some defense mechanisms, and that's why you don't go to funerals nowadays, or you don't want to deal with death, and that's okay just as long as you know it. But
yes,
in crisis care, but the question you're asking me is really all you can do is offer your condolences, offer them prayers, see if there's anything that they can do, because their life is so hectic now, especially people going through the tragedy. They have, it's a tight-knit community. They're probably getting calls from many of their closest relatives, people from out of the country. So really all you can do is offer your condolences right now, listen to them. And then, after everything simmers down, maybe in a couple weeks, maybe you can have more contact with them. Maybe you can reach out. But in a case like this, all the families of the 26 victims, and I don't want to sound simplistic, but they're going to be real busy because they have a lot of people calling from out of town. They're going through their own grief. They're going through their own processing. So to really answer your question, you can't give them answers. You just have to be there with them, be present, let them tell their story, and keep them in your prayers.
And listen, I think that's the best skill. And should one try to meander to walk over to the home and bring them a pie and dinner, or should one do that at all, or wait till one is called upon? That's another question
Well, I would, one of the things that happens in crises like this is people's, when they have that physical reaction where I said one half the brain works and the other doesn't.
Could you teach us what that is? How does that happen? Is that from the shock?
It's from the shock. It's from the crisis. And you have, I forget the... I can't come up with the, I have a diagram that talks about it good, but basically like I said before, when you're in crisis and you're in shock, and everyone can relate to it because there's some one of the listeners, every one of the listeners have had something in their life happen, either at the call in the middle of the night or someone has passed away, a crisis has happened, and they're numb. That's the best feeling to describe it. They're numb. And their whole right side of the brain does not work. I'm just saying it simplistically. And the left side, all the emotions work. So your analyzation, your thought process, the way you take care of yourself, people in crisis, you know, they're not hungry, they don't eat, they don't take care of themselves real well. That part shuts down. That's the simplest way that I could say it without, you know, giving you the PhD formula. So to answer your question, yes, I would extend that love. I would extend that offer of food, even though that you might have, you can't talk to the people. I would do that.
And they're asking me to ask you because they don't want their voices recognized, and I understand that. They want to know, could they possibly be mistaken for being nosy if they come over with, say, a lasagna or something, or should they come and leave it on the porch and knock and then leave? You know what they're asking, if these things
that's based on each situation. I would go, I would do it, I would just offer the gesture. I would reach out. Okay, I would reach out, but the one thing you don't want to do is if you have a conversation with them, you don't want to psychoanalyze. I just don't think, you know, when people are going through this crisis right now that they need to be psychoanalyzed. They just need to be shown love and support. But if they have that opportunity, the one thing I would say is, how do you feel? Are you okay?
Yes, how do you feel? And then
is there anything else I can get for you?
And on that conversation, one knows whether to stay there and sit and listen to them or to leave. I guess they'll instruct us, you know, what they need.
Yes. And doesn't necessarily be turned off if they don't want to talk or they don't want to share. Each person goes through grief differently. Each person goes through crisis and stress differently. Okay? So one of the issues is we all want to help. I want to help the people. Believe me, I want to be there. I want to be sitting in front of someone and helping. We have a whole United States that wants to help them, and it's the loving, giving spirit of that community and people like you and people like me that it's out of our control, but we want to help. We want to make it okay. But the real answer is each of those people and their families, you know, they're going to have to come up with their own meaning to the event, and it'll shatter lives, it'll shatter marriages. Something like this just has a ripple effect, you know, but at this point in time, right after it happens, you know, they don't need any heavy-duty counseling. They don't need any thing. They just need someone to listen, to be with them, and don't drop cliches. Like, everything's going to be okay. This was God's will. That's a cliche I hated to hear. Let's see if I can come up with another one. Oh, with time, this will pass. Okay, that's a terrible one. Okay. The other one was, I know it's going to be tough for a little while, but you're going to feel better. You know, many people.
You're going to feel better in a while. Yes.
Yeah. So there's many people that don't feel better. So another one is, once things die down, things will get back to normal. Well, yes and no.
Kathleen, give me a moment. We're going to have another person join us, and the question will probably be for you.
So to get back to your question, though, you just want to make sure that, you know, if you're with someone that you just don't say these cliches or drop these bombs that can say things worth. Just be there and sit with the person and let them control the conversation. And you have no judgment, okay? You don't ask any questions like, how something happened. I remember when I first started in the hospital, I came upon a lot of situations, and sometimes I would be curious.
Yes.
Well, how did this happen? How did they get injured? But that has nothing to do with it. That should have no part of finding out what happened or finding out, you know, from your perspective. From the other person's perspective, the victim, the person going through it, they can talk about it. But a tendency on helpers is to try to find out exactly how it happened, what were the situations, what were the circumstances, and it's not important. You want to be there for the other person. You want to let them express their feelings, their anguish. Let them talk. You know, ask them open-ended questions. Don't ask them closed-end questions. A closed-end question is a question where they can answer yes or no. You want to ask them an open-ended question, so it takes them like a paragraph in order to answer the question. That gets their feelings out.
And I guess, more importantly, it allows them to grieve.
Yes, it allows them to grieve, but right now they're still in the shock part of the grief. Remember Elizabeth Kubler-Ross with the stages of grief? And people do different stages,
Chaplain,
different areas.
Chaplain, a lot of people aren't familiar with that. Would you go over that with us, please?
Well, I got to do part
that's
of it from memory, but the
That's okay. Even a little bit would be very helpful. We're all in need of this guidance right now. One of the tragic things that happens is how to approach what to say. You have no idea how wonderful it is that you came to the show. It's really, really wonderful that you're here. Please, continue.
Well, sorry about that.
It's okay.
Well, I'm just glad to, you know, to help. The first one that I know of is the first stage is when you're in shock. And it's also denial. It's when something happens and it takes hold of you and you just can't believe it. Like this tragedy. You just can't believe it. If the person or whoever he was committed this act of violence only against his mother and not the children, maybe we could get on with it. But it's the children that really is really traumatic, and we're denying that. I'm denying that that could ever happen, and I still can't believe it unless I watch the TV. So the first stage is denial, shock, bewilderment, trying to find meaning. You know, that comes at a later stage. The second one that I can remember is usually anger. After the denial, after the shock, people are angry. I'm angry. I want to, you know, they interviewed a guy, I don't know who it was on TV, who was a day teacher, and he had just left the school 5 minutes before it opened. I forget who it was. And he was driving home, and then he heard about it. And when they interviewed him, he said, I wish I would have been here 5 more minutes because I wanted to get that SOB. I'm not going to swear on the radio, but he said that SOB. And I could hear the anger, and I could relate to him. And I can relate to him.
You understood. Well, I wanted to
let
you know, Jan is joining us. She's here, and she'd like to join us in the conversation. One moment. Jan, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Jan, this is the chaplain. He's here. Please join us and give us your opinion. Tell us what you feel.
Well, I think that I wouldn't say that I'm numb by any means. However, it seems like it's become a repetitive pattern to have this thing going on. Now, I was raised up in the 60s and 70s, and this just didn't happen. You know, if you get back into history, this stuff didn't start happening up until maybe the last 10, 15, 20 years, or during a time when psychotropic medications became kind of a part of the norm of what the medical and psychiatric profession were handing out like candy. And a lot of people don't understand how these medications are creating this kind of dilemma. But what's happening with the medical profession is that they have no clue as to a person's individual chemical makeup and what their brains are actually doing, you know, the kind of types of neurotransmitters that are being emitted or not emitted.
Yes.
And so what they're doing is that they're hit and missing prescriptions. So they'll just say, well, we're going to try Prozac. And so then they put a person on Prozac, and if the person starts hearing voices, then they take them off of Prozac, and then they put them on something else. And then if that doesn't work, then it's something else and something else. Although what's most common is they'll start with one medication, and when that medication doesn't work, then they'll prescribe another medication or two on top of that to counter the paranoia or the voices or whatever. And so by the time they're done, an individual may have 3, 4, 5 different medications that are all supposed to make them normal. Well, it doesn't make them normal. What it does is it interferes with the natural process of what's going on in a person's brain, and they're not taking the opportunity to take a deeper look at what's going on with the individual. Are they allergic to something? Is this what's causing the behavior problems? Is there some other kind of medical issue? They're not taking the time to look at these things, and then particularly where it involves problematic youth or youth that are displaying mental health issues or hyperactivity. They're just dousing these kids with medications not meant for them. And then these kids are not growing and maturing in a normal fashion. And so they may hit 20 years old, and perhaps they're still on these medications because it's pretty hard to get off of them once you've gotten started on them, and then you've been on them for a number of years. You don't know what normal is anymore.
Right.
Yes.
You know, there's a tendency to become very psychotic and paranoid and delusional about things. And I think men in particular, from what I'm seeing, seem to respond differently to these medications than women do. And I'm not saying that women don't go off the deep end on them, because they do. They're just not doing it in the exact same way. You know, women aren't the ones necessarily who are taking the guns and heading to the schools, you know, and putting on, you know, the gear to go with it. You know, they're not doing it. They may, you know, kill their 3 children, but they're not, it's just not quite the same thing.
Right.
So,
you know,
go
ahead.
So, you know, I think the problem is that we've allowed the pharmaceutical and medical industry to have wholesale license on prescribing and making decisions for our children and for ourselves in a way. You know, I mean, I just went to the doctor the other day, and I'm a vet, so I went to the VA. And they're wanting me to take a flu shot, and I refused, and I said that I use natural things to avoid flu. They didn't like that. And they wanted me to be looked at for vaccinations, and I refused those. And so, you know, my research in the medical industry and what they're doing and some of the side effects of these things, I'm just refusing them. And I'm going into a government facility who is experiencing large volumes of financial benefit through hooking up these pharmaceutical companies, and they're trying to push these drugs and these vaccinations and these flu shots on everybody.
Okay. Well, you know, you're mentioning something that's really key, and I saw it many years ago in the hospital. And, you know, what you're talking about is actually happened, and people don't know about it. Because what's happened is the pharmaceutical companies took over in 1998, they started advertising their drugs to doctors, and then people would research them, and all of a sudden they go into the doctor and they say, I want this drug. What I also saw is exactly what you're saying, is many of the elderly patients who were in the hospital, they were on a blood thinner, they were on a cholesterol pill, they were on an antidepressant, they're on a heart pill, and you take all these together, okay, and the pharmaceutical companies never tested what happens when you take all those together And then with the young kids, you mix a little alcohol or other drugs, and it's a nightmare. So I hear what you're saying, and it actually happens. And so, I hold accountability with a lot of the pharmaceutical companies, because what happens is, you're right, they get people on these pills, and then they stop, and then the problems begin. And many people end up committing suicide.
Right.
And so I hear you on that. But on the other hand, you know, on the grief part of it, because we don't know if that's the exact reason. And by us trying to figure out if this kid was all doped up or if he had autism or whatever he has or whatever caused this, which I'll never figure out, we're losing kind of the meaning of the event, because we'll never find those answers out. And what we have to do, and this is my chaplain training coming back, is we got to make sure that we stay with the people that are hurting, you know, and finding out if this guy, you know, he might have been playing those TV war games. Those things are horrible, okay? And they teach people how to kill. And one of the characters, I think, is a guy with a big black cape. I don't know. I forget what you call it. But it could have been the video games that taught him the violence. We don't know. But that's what our culture has become, is exactly what you said. Is pharmaceutical companies care more about money, they care more about profit, and we are over-medicated. We've been over-medicated for years, actually. I knew it about 10 years ago. We're all over-medicated. I'm not real high on psychiatrists because, number one, they're subjective. Number two, if they can't deal with the problems, they'll just give you a little Valium, or they'll give you Lexapro, or they'll give you some other prescription, and... You're right. People don't take care of their problems when they're on the pills. People have to learn to be accountable and realize that life is tough, and maybe I don't have all the answers, but sometimes rushing to the medication is not the answer, because when they mix the Valium, when they mix the OxyContin with liquor and all that stuff, you know what happens. You said it happens, so I congratulate you on that.
Well, I'm a former chemical dependency counselor, so I'm real familiar with the pharmacological aspects of these things and their interactions and how people are responding. And
how do we know that this guy, you know, whether he was on it or not, was he on any drugs? Do we know if he was on anything?
I can tell you that over 50% of children who are diagnosed with autism are given drugs.
Okay.
And so the percentage is over 50% that I feel confident he had a teacher for a mother who probably didn't want to deal with his behaviors, and I would most likely have to say that she had him drugged. So I'm not 100% certain, but I feel certain enough that it would be 90%. I could be 10% wrong, but I don't think so. So if we're talking about a long history.
But there's also children, young adults out there taking autism pills or some type of medication or counseling that don't do this to schools or innocent kids.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And my response to that would be that every single individual, their chemical makeup is individual. So how one person might respond to a psychotropic medication isn't necessarily how another person is going to respond.
Oh, that's true.
It's the same thing with drinking. You know, if a person, you can take two people, you know, and give them a couple of shots of tequila, you know, one's going to remain normal and the other one might be dancing on the table, You know, it's the same type of thing, because our chemical makeup is so completely different, and we're talking about putting foreign substances in our body that don't belong there. And our bodies will fight these substances and will respond differently to these substances, each one of us individually.
Well, what I was getting at is that, you know, this is a horrendous crime.
Uh-huh.
We're still trying to find meaning. But sometimes when we just blame it on the illness, or we blame it on the pills, yeah, that could be part of the reason. But it really takes accountability, you know, away from the person, because there's many people out there that are on these drugs that don't do violent acts like this. So sometimes when we, if we label them as autism drug, this is why he did it, well, you know, it could just be straight mental illness. Yeah, it might be caused by something, but sometimes, we're just never going to find out what it is. So sometimes, like me, you know, I'll waste a lot of energy if I try to figure out something I'll never find the answer to, and we'll learn about it in a couple of days. My heart, my compassion is more with the families, what they're going through, what the police, the first responders went through, and all the people that have survivor's guilt. Survivor's guilt is big in something like this because, people want to do more, and it's a coulda, shoulda, woulda playing Monday morning quarterback. And having a child die, you know, grief is hard enough. Let me say that. Grief is hard enough with your parents, with your brothers and your sisters, but grief is multiplied 10 times more.
Mm-hmm.
An innocent child, 6 years of age, you know, happens like this. So it's just tremendous. So my expertise is more in, you know, the compassion, being with people, letting them get out and try to find the meaning or to accomplish something like that, because, we're not going to get any legislation for the pharmaceutical companies to not keep pushing pills. That's not going to happen. Psychiatrists aren't going to stop overnight of, you know, writing prescriptions. So that's something that, you know, we'll never be able to control. But what we can control is how we react when our friends get in trouble, when our neighbor's wife passes away, when our brother and sister, have a death close to them. How do we minister to them? So that's more of my expertise.
And she's saying that she's sitting there in Bermuda crying, listening to you. It's so touching her heart. So you don't know, sometimes we think we're not ministering to people, and in just participating in this radio program, you're ministering to people as far away as Bermuda who are heartbroken and listening to you and hanging on to your every word. Jen, I wanted to ask you, you were saying you were a counselor for people who are having difficulties with drugs. Would you tell us about that? Share that with us?
You know, if I'm going to try to relate it a little bit to this current circumstance, I think that trauma, anytime you have substances involved in a person's life, trauma is automatically what follows. And I think that I've dealt with a lot of trauma in people's lives. Some of it's self-inflicted. Some of it is what I would call true victimization. I know I've worked with people who got fed alcohol as infants, created a whole lot more victims, and it just snowballed. It snowballed to the place where everyone in the country and now across the globe are just grieving and shocked at this action. The point that I was trying to make is that substances create deception. And that's what we're experiencing a lot of. Good grief. You know, I went to a function down in San Diego a few years ago, and there were a whole bunch of high-powered folks there. We're talking about assistant attorney generals and judges and people working at different agencies, and we're all down there examining a drug court. And we would go through the day, because we're talking about legislation on this a little bit, we would go through the day examining the drug courts and examining these agencies, and then after we were done, everybody wanted to get together to discuss what it was that they had observed on how to fix societal problems, and they wanted to go to the bar. Okay, so I didn't drink, but I went to the bar to have this discussion with them, and I observed at least four people that I personally would have put in inpatient treatment. And then I observed another five people that I would have put into outpatient treatment, and we're talking about over a 2 or 3 day period observing their drinking patterns, okay? And we're talking about people in high levels of government, in state government primarily, who are responsible for getting legislation enacted, executing agency policy, et cetera, et cetera. So the problem goes all the way up to the highest level of government, from where we're talking about a 20-year-old young man, all the way up. It is a deception, and so many people are chemically bound and making decisions under the influence of various different chemicals, whether you're talking about alcohol or whether you're talking about prescribed medications. And this is one of the problems why we have difficulty getting these things addressed, because they don't want to address it. Either they're chemically dependent themselves and they're completely in denial about substance abuse, or they are taking kickbacks from the pharmaceutical companies. And so now we're left with a global problem, because it's not just the United States, it's every country right now is kind of involved in chemical use of one type or another, with an unnatural thinking process that goes with that. So we're talking about a certain type of evil that has set into our globe and into our decision-making processes. And so when it comes to solving the problem, we have to get down to the heart of the matter. And the heart of the matter is dealing with man's inclination towards being drawn towards things that are not healthy for them, and being drawn towards violence, and being drawn towards sexual perversions, and being drawn towards chemical use. It's not one thing or another. It's like the entire globe right now is on tilt. And so this is just nothing more than a manifestation of things coming to a head about the nature of man and how the decisions are being made under the influence of substances all the way up to the highest levels of government. That's my opinion.
Jan and Chaplain and Jan, I just wanted you to know that the importance of what we're discussing here today has drawn more than 1,000 people who are sitting here hanging on to the edge of their seats listening to you. What you're saying is so significant and so poignant that you have a room full you have a huge audience right now, live audience.
Huh. Well, hello,
that's
everybody. Glad you're here.
Yes, that's just at Blog Talk Radio alone. That's not outside. You have people from Google listening in, and you've got people from overseas listening in. What you're saying is tremendously significant, and I can't thank you both for joining me. You are so welcome. You made this program. You are so welcome, because opinions are valid.
Well, listen, I appreciate it, but I just want to make sure that we don't lose the point of the phone call. Is that our heart and prayers, are for the victims, are for the families, are for everyone in that Connecticut town. So, as when I was a chaplain, I don't do it for my pleasure. I do it because that's the gift God gave me. So I appreciate your candor and your acknowledgments, but I still really feel bad about what's gone on over there, and that should be our main focus right now. And our prayers and support should be with
one of the number one points that keeps coming up again and again through these 3 hours that this show has been on is that they don't know how to grieve, they don't know how to approach the family, and we've had now 19 calls from the Connecticut area. They don't want to have their voices heard, but their questions are all the same. How do I approach my neighbors? How do I approach my sister? My sister lost her child. I didn't lose mine. How do I approach? And what's interesting to me is that they have an assigned law enforcement officer for every family, and they have their own grief counselors, yet they're calling syndicated news because they heard there's a chaplain here. And when they heard that Jan is a veteran, groups from the bases started calling that have called in the past, they're listening to you as well, Jan.
Okay.
You are very welcome here, and I can't thank you enough, both of you, for joining us today. Grieving is something that's difficult, and a lot of us don't know how to grieve, how to support someone who has suffered a great loss. And as the chaplain said, embrace them and sit there, and what did you say, open-ended questions, so that they have to engage, not close-ended, not yes or no questions, correct?
Ask open-ended questions. You don't have to find an answer to your own question. Don't drop any cliches. Don't necessarily, it's up to you, you know, but, you know, psychologize what I'd like to talk about it, because they're just going through grief. They're still in the initial stages, and they can't process anything you give them anyway. So just being present, being there, listening to them, and respect, and also respecting their wishes. And there might not be anything that you can do, but we want to do it. And
we have a call now. Do you have something to contribute?
Hello, this is Richard Lowry.
Oh, Richard, thank you for calling in. Richard Lowry is a military historian, and he not only has an array of books, he also is a contributor and a member owner of syndicatednews.net. Welcome, Richard. Please contribute. Please join us.
Well, I haven't heard too much of the conversation, but the only words that I have, first, are words of sympathy and my most heartfelt thoughts for all the victims and their families in Connecticut. It's a real tragedy of what's happening in America nowadays with these random acts of violence. And the only contribution I think I have to make to the discussion is that we really shouldn't spend so much time in the media talking about these events, because it only encourages the next person.
Well, we will take that into account and speak about it less. Today, what I wanted to talk about was, and the chaplain has helped us, is to teach us how to approach a family who suffered a great loss. And the 19 calls from Connecticut specifically were about exactly that. They're calling to ask a method of approaching a family in a most respectful way, in a way that doesn't injure them. And a lot of regular folk don't know how to do that, me included.
Oh, and then that's a wonderful subject. Like I said, I haven't been listening too much to what you've been talking about, and I certainly wasn't talking about syndicated news. I'm talking about the mass media and how this has been on for over 24 hours, and that's all they're talking about. It only encourages people like this to go off and try to do something even more heinous to get notoriety.
Actually, I'm so glad you mentioned that. We haven't talked about the salacious aspect of it and the exciting aspect of it. The only aspect we've discussed in these 3 hours with the chaplain from La Jolla, California, and Janet, and what we've talked about is how to approach a grief-stricken family who's lost a child. And all of the questions I've received, Richard, in the last 2 hours are from that area and people asking about, you know,
And that is a very meaningful discussion, and I'm glad you're having it.
Yes, and we have a chaplain present from La Jolla, California. Chaplain, this is Richard Lowry. He's a military historian. He belongs to us here, and we love having him here at syndicatednews.net.
Hey, thank you very much. And, I appreciate his candor, and he sounds like a very blessed man. You know, one thing he did say is that there were already today two copycat killings. I don't know if you've heard. I haven't heard about it on the news. There was one in Las Vegas, where a guy unfortunately walked into the concierge's desk and his girlfriend was working behind. He shot her, and then he killed himself right in the Excalibur Casino. That was number one.
Wow.
Number two. Now, yeah, number one. Number two, down in Alabama, there was a gentleman, and I don't know, you know, what it was for. I didn't really read past the heading, but he was in a hospital, and he injured three people, and he was shot dead. So the very, very next day. So you're right about that, about keeping that, you know, out of the media, it shouldn't keep us from addressing, you know, when we eventually find out what caused this, to take some type of, you know, action. But for right now, as family, as people around the world, people in the United States, people in Connecticut are going through this, you know, we'll have time to find out those answers.
To let you all know that this has been one of the most glorious conversations and a wonderful panel that we've had here today. And we've come to the close of our 3 hours. I can't thank you enough for participating. Chaplain, you have been a godsend, truly. And Jan, I can't thank you enough for your contribution. And Richard, of course, as always, you're always welcome here. This is your home. I can't thank you enough, all of you. You have been just darling. And we are going to say good night because we've come to the end of the show. Thank you all for participating. Thank you.
And thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And thank you for having that conversation, Ruthie.
You're so welcome. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you, Chaplain. You've been so, so helpful. We can't thank you enough.
God bless you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming at such a time of grief. And I know your words are consoling people right now. And don't worry, the machine continues to record. So we know that
have me on again, you know, tomorrow or something. Maybe we can complete the, you know, the five stages of grief and what people are going through or something like that.
Oh, that would be lovely. And the show tomorrow is actually from California. But you are most welcome to join us. But it starts at 8 o'clock in California time, which is 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. If you'd like to join us, the show is bilingual. It's conducted by its host, Mr. Eduardo Quesada, and we join him to support him. So we would love to have you join us for that.
And what's the show about?
It's the same thing we're talking about tonight. It's exactly the same thing,
only
that it's bilingual. It's English and Spanish.
Okay, I have to brush up on my Spanish then.
Oh, don't worry. You can participate in English because everyone on the show is bilingual.
Okay.
So please do participate. We appreciate having you join us, and the number is the same. The same call-in number, you have it?
Okay, yep. Well, listen, God bless you, and just everyone keep everyone in their prayers, you know, over in Connecticut, the families, the first responders, that's all I can say is keep everyone definitely in your prayers because they need it.
Thank you. Thank you, Chaplain. We've loved having you here. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.